this is Mary J. Blige.
I'm Nicki Minaj.
What's up, what's up? This is Jay-Z.
From London, England and Washington, D.C., you are now tuned in to Conversations with Allison J. The Journey to Here, brought to you by Ethel May Books. This is Conversations with Allison J. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Conversations with Allison J., The Journey to Here. Today, as always, we have another captivating and thought-provoking topic and guest. Here's your host, Allison J.
I'm telling you, if some people knew what some prisoners have when they actually leave prison, regardless of what they've done, you know, and it's not about excusing wrong. It's about treating someone humane. And when you see some of them come out, they've got this little see-through plastic bag. I don't mean it's not a fancy, it's not a carrier bag. When you see some of them at some of the prisons, that's what they come out with, a little bag.
They've got practically nothing. You mean like a Ziploc bag, like a...
There's no zip. There's no zip. No, but you know, like there's no lock. Yep.
You know, clear. That's it. That's the word I'm looking for. A clear.
Absolutely. Yeah. Clear plastic bag coming out. Some have got a like a bin liner looking thing coming out. And people don't understand. They say, well, you know, they keep doing the same thing and keep going back in that. But the time I was doing a volunteer thing with our church, and we would be going to meet them because we'd get notification that certain people are being released. And quite often we'd go in and see them before and talk to them, tell them what we could do to help them. And we would be there to meet them. And across the road, you'll see friends or foes also waiting for them. What did we have to offer them? It wouldn't get them rich. It would just be a way of getting them into a hostel, maybe for a week, because that's as long as it is often. Maybe something to eat, you know. We try and give them a little bag of this and, you know, so that they can go here and go there, get some food, come and make some phone calls, and people could help them with their benefits and different things like that.
Applications and things like that.
Yeah. Whereas their mates, their old mates who left them in the lurch quite often.
Well, they'll probably drag them back into that life.
Yeah. We'll see you go right.
Yeah.
You know, and it's a bit of a toss up.
Yeah, for them, especially it's because I can imagine it's going back to the life that you know, going back to what's familiar, or trying Absolutely. This new thing, this new uncertain thing. And I can just imagine that the mental trauma that could possibly put on somebody, because you've just come out of being locked up, some of them for years.
Yep. No money.
Yeah, and I can see the temptation for some of them, and especially if some of them are struggling mentally, it can, you know, that going back out can be such a huge adjustment.
Yeah. And often it was because who could offer them what they need. And the fear factors of who might come after them, knowing that they've been spurned at the prison gate.
Yes.
And they've gone off with these people call themselves Christians, you know, doing good deeds and stuff like that. It doesn't, for some people, there's no prospect in it. No. So it's a very hard one, but it means that their life moving forward becomes harder and harder, and it's easier to do the familiar, which will get them back in there. It's one thing a lot of criminals don't learn. that doing the same thing all the time will get you back to the same place all the time.
Definition of insanity, right?
Absolutely. Yeah. How could you possibly think the way out of crime is more crime?
It's one of those things where we don't really think about. We just think, oh, they're bad, they're a criminal. But we Absolutely. Don't often think, actually, could it be deeper than that? Could there be something literally mentally going on for that person?
Yeah.
And going to your point of saying that they fall into two categories, those that are deemed competent. So you can call a person with a mental health challenge that is deemed competent, that is in a maximum security prison, not getting any kind of help. And then you wonder why some of these people come back out and reoffend.
Yeah, because they don't have to think about the bills. They don't have to think about this. They, you know, some come out and they're showing you the money and they're saying, how much is this?
Wow.
Because coins have changed, notes have changed.
Yes.
And when they're not dealing with money, because some of what goes on in the prison is kind of barter, you know, I give you this, you give me that and stuff like that. But to be really money conscious and then to ask them to budget.
Yeah, because I'm sure, first of all, when they said, how much is this? I'm thinking, hold on a second. But you can see that this says 10. You can see, but it's not really how much is this as opposed to what does it add up to? It's more, what is the value of this that I have in my hand?
Yes,
of course.
Yeah, so it's a difference between the value and the cost.
Yes. And my mind was first going to, well, it adds up to whatever it adds up to. But no, it's the value. What can I do, literally? What can I do with this?
What can I get? Yeah. And when they realize that, you know, for some hostels, for example, they will have to pay a certain amount of money per night. And this is what happens to a lot to the homeless people. They will give them a room for the night. But when you got no job and you got no this and you got no that, so you beg on the street so that you can collect enough money to sleep in the hostel for the night and be chucked out first thing in the morning.
Yeah, I remember I have experienced that a couple of times. I remember being on my way home from work or going out. And I remember I was walking towards, I was passing a supermarket. And there was a man outside and he was actually asking for money for a hostel. And I didn't understand, because obviously I didn't understand that it was something that they had to pay per night or whatever. And I remember giving him some money and I remember I had like a sandwich and some juice in my bag. And I gave it to him. But you just saying that has actually given me a bigger understanding now. Yeah. Should somebody now come to me and say they want some money for a hostel, I can, because I'm going to be honest, a lot of the times when we look at people begging, like, are you going to buy alcohol and drugs with the money?
I
just gave you, because it doesn't give you the money I just gave you. I'm not going to need the money.
Yeah.
We all kind of go through that in our mind.
Yep.
Because sadly, that's the assumption that we make, that all homeless people, they're homeless because they're drug addicts and drunks.
Yeah. And it's not like that.
No, it isn't, is it?
No. I mean, even in hospitals, sometimes, you know, people being discharged from hospital and the desire and the try is to make sure they have somewhere to go. But occasionally, you're sending somebody back to a place where they're being abused. Because that's home. And people don't always tell what's gone on there, you know? And so sometimes they get out of there, they go there one night, if they go, and they end up back on the streets. So there's a whole host of things that we can look at as we go on our daily chores, our daily day-to-day travels. But there is something else behind all of that, you know? And what's all of that has led me to the place where I kind of thought to myself, what do I do with all the skills and the knowledge and everything that I have as a last fling off life, the last fling of work in life, I should say, in that. And 10 years before I decided, my supervisor actually said to me, I think you should become a chaplain. And I just said, nah. He says, why not? I said, oh, there's just too much politics at church. It's just, you know, it's best if I don't.
And as
it's best if I don't.
As a pastor's wife, you know, and about the politics that can go on in church. And I'm not saying this to not church, born and raised in it. Yes, I kind of went my own way for many years, but now I'm back. But it's a fact and it's the truth.
Yeah, yeah. I just felt I'd like a straight path, and that would give me too much hassle. But then when I was fully convinced of it, I went back and said to the supervisor, this is what I really feel I need to do now. I feel that I now need to fulfill my call, which is to set people free who are bound and to shed light in the dark. So that is where I got to. And the strangest thing about this, Alison, is I decided this, say the December, January time. And I told my supervisor maybe a month or so afterwards. I didn't tell my husband for a while. But I had all of this, and it was working out through me. And I tend to spend a long time thinking about things. And the one day I got him, and I said, and I told him, this was perhaps about the April now. And he said, yeah, that would really suit you. And I thought, okay. So I told another, you know, couple of people close by to me. He said, that's what I want to do. Yeah, that would really suit you. And as I kind of went on and the year went on, and I was trying to have some meetings, important meetings to talk to people about this, I suddenly realized that only one person asked me, why would you want to do that? And I thought, one amongst many, you don't matter. And I thought, from that response, a bit like the example of the taken aback, I wasn't quite taken aback. I just thought, sure, you don't understand, and maybe you don't need to understand.
And that's what I was going to say, you know, not everybody is going to get your vision. And one of the things I say is like, look, ordinarily I wear glasses. And if I take my glasses off and I can't see what you see, don't get mad at me because I can't see what you see. Impaired.
Yes. Yeah. And I think when you know yourself, where you're at, what other people say doesn't really matter that much. You know? And I cannot afford to allow what people say or think of me to make me not do the things that I need to do.
And to not walk in your purpose and your calling, that's more important though, isn't it?
Yeah. Even I had to understand that. You see, because my pride, them years before, said too much politics, can't be bothered, not doing it. Yeah. But when the time came and I had to face it and I had to say, this is what I feel. And do you know the strangest thing about it all? Everybody was saying, what's that? What's that? You want to become a minister so that you could do, so, you know, and what will you need? And, you know, and what support will you need? And this kind of, and the questions were thick and fast. But up until that point, I'd already done my research. So I was able to put it together to do a presentation for my ministerial team and answer the questions and shed a bit of light on what was chaplaincy. Not everybody understood or went along with it, but enough people went along with it for me to get past the first hurdle. But like some of the training within some of our churches, you kind of do enough. So there was that. Yeah, there was lots of training to do and some practical things to do. However, I said to them, I want to become a full chaplain. And it was like, well, what's a full chaplain to a half chaplain?
Some people, and I would have to ask you to explain to some people, what is a chaplain?
Well, a chaplain is the general purpose of a minister within a church, for example. But chaplains tend to work outside of the church.
Right.
Or if they work in church, they work in a specific area. So the ministry of a chaplain tends to meet people where they're at. So the airs and graces don't necessarily, well, are not part of it. It's not part of your day.
Follow the role of a chaplain, because a chaplain, so if I can get my head around this, so a chaplain is, so when you hear like you're a chaplain of a prison, or you're a chaplain in, because I know somebody that's a chaplain of a football club.
And yes.
So therefore, you are the minister over that, as opposed to a church where everybody's a Christian and everybody's saved and everybody.
Yeah.
So you are that person that they know, for example, when you work in prisons, so you are that person they know that, for any kind of spiritual help, they can come to you. But then they also know that you work in the mental health arena, so they get a double whammy. They're getting a two-double whammy. They want to talk to somebody about their mental state, they can come. They want to talk about their spiritual state, they can come to you.
So I currently work in the National Health Service. So I'd be glad. There are healthcare chaplains that work in what you call the acute hospitals that deal with everything. Whereas for me, it's mental health. Right. And mental health, we've got a wide area to cover called the Black Country. And so I do adult mental health. I don't do children's mental health. Rarely comes up. I do learning disability. Right. We also have dementia. And I do older adults.
Okay, and you say that covers the Black Country. So the Black Country, if my memory serves me right, that's like Wolverhampton, that kind of area.
Wolverhampton, Dudley, a tiny bit of Birmingham, which is classed as Sandwell, Walsall, Wensbury, all of those kinds of areas. It's quite a big area in that to cover. So that's where I got to. And, you know, I often laugh when I tell people how I got into chaplaincy, because I made up my mind and I knew what I wanted to do. I wanted to study chaplaincy. I didn't just want to do it because you're a minister, because I've got lots of experience, I could get the job. A job was advertised just at the point where I started telling people. Six people sent me the advert. Six people. And it was like, whoa. Advert came out. We were going to Barbados. And so I was sort of thinking about it. So whilst we was in Barbados, thank God for the internet, I sent off an email to say, yes, I was interested, came back and I started to. And it's the longest form I've ever had to fill in my life.
Ouch.
When I counted the various pages in the end, ran into 23 pages.
That's application form.
Application form.
What information could they possibly want that covers 23 pages? Was it like one question per page or something?
Well, I had to write stuff about me as well, right? And when you've lived for a long time, it's not just having a lot to say, but you know a lot of things. You've been a lot of places, and
yeah,
you have loads of certificates and, you know, all sorts of things. And they ask you how you would do the job.
Mm.
Well, more than general, but yes, because they want to look deeper to see right. if you had the stamina and the whatever else. Mm. And I was not an NHS person. So to get an NHS interview was a big deal.
Mm.
So I got it, went for the job, interviewed really well, and somebody else said that she'd done chaplaincy work. So, and for all that she's done chaplaincy work, she was 1 point ahead of me. A bex? Anyway. Because she took a while to say yes, mm. I kept hoping. And when she took the job, I was beside myself. And I kept saying, that job is mine. Mm. That job, in my heart, I felt that job was mine. So I offered to volunteer and do the stuff because I'd need a placement anyway right. for my university course.
Mm-hmm.
So we got it all tied up and I was going to start uni the September. And I started volunteering the March. And by July, I was getting these emails back from the person who got the job, you know, and questions and different things and stuff like that. And I was thinking, surely it ought to be the other way around. But anyway, I carried on. And then I started to have supervision from the boss, who is now my boss.
So you got supervision from the boss or the person that got the job?
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Because I was now on placement, so somebody had to supervise me, so she did. And I used to say to people, in my heart, I believe that job is mine. And one day, we was having a supervision, and I decided I wanted to see her reaction, because don't forget, I'm a psychotherapist.
Mm.
So I said to her, do you know, she was writing, and I said, I still believe that job is mine. And she was completely opaque, so professional, never said anything. And then the November, she sent me an email to say, the job is going to become vacant. Are you still interested? She said, it may only be half or 1 day a week. Yes. Because for me, I thought, I just need to get my toe around the door.
Mm.
And I know I'm in.
Yeah, I was about to say, because you're kind of already in there anyway.
Because I was volunteering for them, mm. of course, that helps to put me to the top of the list. Because 6 months had gone, I had to do another interview.
Right.
So they had to advertise a job and da 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 and all the rest of it and that. But the job was mine and I got the job.
You believed in your heart all this time and you
took it. I just, you know, it's kind of strange you're telling somebody you know something and you've got no evidence. I mean, that is really what faith is about, isn't it?
I was about to say, that's all faith.
Yeah, no evidence. It's in here. And, you know, I'd often say at home and you'd get a, but you didn't get the job kind of thing, you know? So anyway, so I started part-time and then next year I went full-time. And the strangest thing is I am the only full-time chaplain. My boss was full-time, but she did two jobs within the trust. And then when she gave up the one half, she does like 4 days a week. My job is like 5 days a week. Some days I struggle and I batter, but boy, I get there. Because I believe fully that I am fully in the right place, purpose and calling anointing and everything else is working together. Mm. And when I got there in 2014, and I was like 59, I think I was 59, I think the maths work out well, in there. And then I was kind of going 60 when I got the job. Whereas in the NHS, most people at 60 are retiring.
Mm.
So there's people that I had known, or that they were walking out the door as they were 60, and I was walking in the door as I was 60. So, yeah, that's pretty much how I got here. The counselling and psychotherapy really helped, because that's also a major part in terms of chaplaincy, being able to listen. And it's great because you can be a full minister. I can do everything, marry people, bury them, you know, and all the rest of that. So I can do all of that officially, and still be able to, you know, meet people where they're at without the starch and the...
Everything
else.
A lot of people away, though, the four walls of a church. So, and you come without that. So that is very, very encouraging for people that want to seek mental health care, but don't know where to go. Thinking about it and seeing that you do the one-on-one therapy and the counselling for premarital and couples, and I was looking at your website and I saw something, I'm like, I must ask you about this. It's like, you know, changing lanes a little bit. And it says, when married life does not meet your expectations, how would you... counsel couples on that? And one of the reasons that I wanted to ask you that is because there are so many people that focus so much on the wedding and putting a ring on it and being Mrs. So-and-so that they've lost, or they didn't stop to think about, being a wife. Because being a wife is very different. I remember, because I got married late. Because I remember before getting married, I didn't live with anyone or anything of the sort. So that being a wife, I was the independent person that if I wanted it, I would work to go get it, do something. And I remember one of the things that would cause a big issue is, because anybody that really knows me knows I'm a workaholic. I am. And that's something that's like, Lord, I need deliverance, but I am a workaholic. So, and I'm typically the person that if I'm working on something, I don't want to go home till it's done. Because I don't actually want to come into it the next morning unless it's a project that's going on. And I would never call to say, I'm going to be late. I've never had to do that. There was nobody at home waiting for me. So I wouldn't call, because in my head, I'm at work. What's your problem? It's not like I said, oh, I'm out and it's 10 o'clock at night and you don't know where I am or who I'm with. I'm at work. So I wouldn't call, and it would be a big deal. And so there were some expectations that I never stopped to consider, just never thought about it. So what would you say then to those people that married life just didn't meet their expectations?
Okay. If they had premarital counselling from me, expectations is one of the things I talk about.
Hmm.
What you expect from each other, and what you expect from that union. Yeah. So expectations would be explained. And a lot of it would be explained through the root of how you communicate, because that is also a very big issue. People who do not communicate their expectation It's all going on in here.
Well, people that just don't communicate.
No, but well, that's a bigger issue. But people who do not communicate that they have an expectation.
Mm.
We all have expectations. And the ones that are not verbalized create the most problems.
That's interesting.
If you verbalize an expectation and the person says, I can't meet that, then you know that.
Mm.
It's going to be a problem. But if you don't verbalize it and you have it, the first thing that happens is you become disappointed. You become annoyed. You become irritated. You get to the place where it becomes an issue. You become resentful. Mm-hmm. And you make hints, and then hints don't work. One of the things I say to couples, particularly to women, never hint to a man. He will not get it. And when you're clear, be prepared to repeat it and to remind them.
Mm.
Don't take it personally. It has nothing to do with you. We are wired differently. And I say the same thing to the men. And earlier on you said, don't know how to be a wife because this, that, and all the others. Neither does a man know how to be a husband. And the focus is on the wedding. And a lot of people don't prepare for the afterwards. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So we do a lot of preparation for the afterwards. And the person for whom it doesn't meet their expectations, when they come into my arena, it is, what is your? What are your expectations from person and your expectations from the marriage, mm-hmm. which are two different things. But sometimes people think that getting married solves all of these problems that they've ever heard about or ever had. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't. It creates some of its own.
Yes.
Yeah, that you've not had. And so my thing would be to get them to write down their expectations, do some work on it, tell the person. And what's really interesting, I'll say, well, do you want to tell the person what your expectations are? And like I'm looking at you and you're looking at me, it becomes...
They find everything else to look at.
Yeah. Well, you know, and one of the things that I find quite hilarious, but not when you're sitting there, it isn't. They talk about all these wonderful things that they would like from marriage, you know, and sometimes I give them the exercise to do, so they've done it on the flip chart. So those premarital, they do it separately and then they bring it and we work on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I sometimes say, okay, do you want to read yours and you read yours? Are there any surprises and so on and so forth? And what I have, and I have this more with Christian people getting married than with anybody else, and there is normally no sex on it. And I say, oh, so you're planning for a really happy marriage and this, that, and that, and you're not going to have any sex. You know, and people think, well, no, can't talk about, you know, well, we didn't know. I says, well, you've had the list of the subjects that we're going to cover, and one of them is talking about sexuality and stuff like that, sex and sexuality, and family planning. You know, we're talking about those sorts of things. So, oh, well, yeah. Yeah.
I can't.
You know, so if something like that, in terms of getting married, is not actually on the agenda, and then partly you can then see that that was going to be an issue that cannot be talked about. And sometimes people leave things out like money, you know, and stuff like that. And you have to remind them that all of this costs.
Yes.
You know, we need,
to talk about finances, because isn't that one of the biggest things that lead to divorce? Finances.
Well, people say it's finances. I've got a slightly different take on it, which is it's people's approach to money.
Yeah.
So I'd say, well, what's your concept of money? For some people, have it, spend it, don't have it, don't spend it. You know, don't have it, borrow it from, you know, and things like that. So we look at how you plan.
Mm-hmm.
So we look at financial, you know, how you plan your finances, because people think they've got a job, they've both got two good jobs, so everything's going to be fine.
Mm.
And I think actually that's a false sense of security. Having a lot of money can ruin you if you don't have any plans for it.
Mm-hmm.
Like having no money and making no plans to get any.
Mm.
Yeah, or only living off other people's money. So we talk a lot about backgrounds and, you know, how things were dealt with and then. And I say, well, if things were dealt in a good way and you can both agree that it's good and you want to continue, that's fine. It's not my business in that sort of sense. But if we see that things don't work, we have to plan for it differently so that it works.
Mm.
So that's where, for me, a lot of expectations not being met comes from, because people generally haven't spoken about it.
So then that leads me nicely into how to premarital counselling, how important would you say that is? Because if they went to that, then maybe some of these expectations would have been discussed beforehand. So it wouldn't be a thing now where married life does not meet your expectations.
No. If somebody has come and they've done the sessions and the work that they've done is theirs, so the flip chart papers belong to them.
Mm-hmm.
The exercises, the home exercises, the written notes that they will take belong to them. The typed up sheets belong to them. And, you know, I don't even type one set of sheet for a couple. I do two.
So they have their own.
Absolutely.
Mm.
Absolutely. So if they've come and they've done the full session, the full course, then really what generally happens is my advice to them before they leave me is you have your notes. You cannot remember everything.
Mm.
But when certain things come up, you can revisit your notes. You know, if things go drastically wrong or you really think you can't find a way to sort it out, you know where I am. Or you find yourself a counsellor who will do various things. Mm-hmm. So what I do for my couples, we have six sessions. They pay for five. They have five before they get married.
Right.
And the sixth session is a gift, which they have after they are married. And the general rule is mm-hmm. you take it from 9 months to a year afterwards. You come back and you do a check-in, you look over stuff, you talk about how things have gone. Unless things happen before the 9 months yeah. that you think you need to check back with me, you can. And sometimes it's quite simple. And some couples have come and had half a session to save their half for the time.
Yes, yes, got it.
And that's because sometimes, because they've done the sessions, it's generally quite easy to, you know, say, remember this, 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 or do this, or something like that, and go off. Some people never take their last session, but then, you know, it's a gift, so if you don't take it.
Exactly. And then you do one-on-one counselling as well. So what kind of reasons could a person come to you for the one-on-one?
Many. Many different reasons. Some people, when some people know what I do or are told some things I do, and if they have, some people have mental health issues and they don't want to go through the system. And if people are treated right and know what to do, even if they do need medication, they can get medication as part of a package help without having to go down the route of waiting till everything's gone too far wrong that they have to be sectioned. Right. So not everybody has to go through that route. And that is one of the things that I would encourage people to do. Seek help early. Because right. sometimes people come and they're so bad, I say to them, I won't see you until you get medication.
Right. And this is to stop them from being sectioned, or as they say over here, Baker acted. Yeah, because it's I do believe it's called like the Baker Act. But when you say it together, it just sounds like what? Because the first time I heard like
Baker acted.
It's like the Baker Act, so they get Baker acted.
So you
encourage them to get medication.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
because that could actually prevent that from happening, right?
Yes, because it's part of the.
Yeah,
it's part of the Mental Health Act.
Right.
And then they come in different numbers. And you want to avoid some numbers. Some people go involuntary, and if all goes well, then they can go home. But some people go involuntary and end up being sectioned. Mm-hmm. So depending on how people are, I sometimes see people, and sometimes people are depressed and they've denied it. Mm-hmm. That anything is really that wrong with them. And if you say to them, well, have you considered these kinds of things, this, if you say this, and this has happened to you, the chances are equal to this. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And sometimes people are living with anxiety that eats out the rest of their lives. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And all sorts of other things. Sometimes people are living with secrets. And then that, it's hard, or it's either their secret or their partner's secret or somebody else's and all sorts of things. But I often say to people, I will deal with you because you're in the room. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I can't deal with this person and that person. I can help you to have a different relationship with them, mm-hmm. but I can't. You know, want me to heal the whole family, or you know, the whole family needs to come to care.
So
don't work that way.
Yeah, and that is so true, because so many people are walking around with another person's secret or another person's shame or another person's guilt, mm. and it's affecting their mental health. And what Absolutely. They need to do is learn how to compartmentalize it almost. And kind of detach themselves, especially if it's something that is not theirs. It's like it's because I remember there was an incident in my family, and my uncle got incarcerated, and I was just like, the shame of, and especially because of why, I'm like, oh no. Mm-hmm. And the shame of it was almost like I took that on, like I did it.
Yeah.
When I had to say, you know something, his shame is not mine.
Yes, some people can't do that.
Yeah, and I had to yes, he's my uncle. It is what it is. Mm-hmm. But I have to kind of push that to be over there. Otherwise, it would affect my mental state. And it's not even something that it's not something I did, not something I could have prevented.
Mm. Yeah.
I fully get that. Mm-hmm. And it's funny because sometimes you take on the shame and the guilt of another person, thinking that everybody's going to be looking at you like, oh my God, you've got a family member that did this horrendous thing. When the reality of it is, there aren't going to be those people that do that. Don't get me wrong. And they're going to shun you because of what somebody else did. But I found that the majority of people are grown enough to know that, well, yeah, you're still you. You didn't do it.
Yeah.
And I was just like, oh, yeah, okay. And it's, again, going back to what we said earlier, it's not giving people enough credit sometimes. Mm-hmm. In that sense.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And sometimes, I mean, we've got a couple of phrases that we use often in this house of two people. One is, it's easier to ask pardon than beg permission.
I said that to somebody the other day. I said, I'd rather ask for forgiveness than ask for permission. Just the other day.
Because you may never get it.
Exactly. And many times, once you've gone ahead and done something, you probably don't even need to ask for forgiveness because they're like, oh, wow, okay, thank you.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a fear factor.
Mm-hmm.
And that fear factor often, what if? And I always say to people, you don't have to cross the bridge until you come to it.
Mm.
But a lot of people would like to cross all their bridges, sorted out everything, so that when they get there, you know, and I'm thinking, actually, you've got life to live here now.
Yeah.
Rather than spend time.
But some people, but you know what? Now that you've actually said that, what just came to me, you know, some bridges we may never get to.
Yeah. I say that often.
Yeah. Wow, there's some bridges we're already planning, like, in order to cross that bridge, I need to do this, 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 and this. And then life is still happening. Then life leads, and it actually doesn't lead to the bridge.
Absolutely. What a waste of energy. What else could you have been doing in that time?
And not only that, I could have been getting some quality sleep.
Hey. Yes.
Some quality sleep and a rest and just enjoying being present in the moment. Wow.
And just back to what you said, we also, the other phrases, there seem to be more punishment than praise. And therefore, we need to credit ourselves, give the praise where it's rightfully deserved. Because sometimes people are waiting for somebody else to praise them, and it's not going to happen. Again, disappointment because of expectations.
Right.
So it happens in all walks of life that what really got to me is I had an expectation.
Yeah.
But I'm the only one who knew.
Yeah, because we think people are mind readers, right? That we're just going to have this expectation.
Absolutely.
So have it here in our head, and you're supposed to know what the expectation is, and not just are you supposed to know what's in my head, you're supposed to meet what's in my head without me ever verbalizing it.
Absolutely. To be a wonderful person, you'd have to be that. And unless you're that, you're not a wonderful person. Wow. And some people take that to heart, you know, in that. So, yeah.
Love it. This has been an education for me. And I thank you. Where can people find you if they want to get in touch?
Well, right about now, I'm hiding from everybody.
As is the whole world right now.
Because the truth is, in terms of some of the things that's actually going on, yes, you can find me. I'm on, if most people were to type my name in to a search, you'd find me. Yeah. You might find some old numbers and some that, but generally there are some things that never change about me, and I tend to just give out my novelette Aldred at btinternet.com. Okay. I tend to give that one out because it's easy. I use my Tranquility one rarely, and that's largely because my full-time job is in chaplaincy.
Right.
So I don't advertise my services. It's because people have known me or somebody sends somebody my way and that. And certainly within this lockdown period, I'm doing it by Zoom.
Right.
Some people are telephone, but, you know, or FaceTime. I like FaceTime because FaceTime makes me feel like the person is in the room with me, even more so than Zoom and any of the other platforms. We use about 5 different platforms at work at the moment because we're all working, well, some of us are working from home. I'm working from home largely and rarely go out to do things. Some things you can't help, you know, like if you go out to lead a memorial or of something physical, you know, and or if somebody dies, you know, that's also part of our job. Being there, very present. So we've had to work in different ways. Some people like it, some people don't. Mm-hmm. But I tend to use what I have. And this is what we have now, and I'm happy to use that. So, yeah.
Thank you. So if anybody wants to find you, you are a chaplain. You work for the NHS.
Yeah.
And you just, like you said, just put your name in Google and they'll find you. Novlet Aldred. Novlet, thank you so much. I have... Every time I speak to you, I learn something, and I'm so grateful for that, because we can talk about everything and nothing, but then we can talk about some real things and just learn.
Yeah.
So grateful for you. I'm grateful for you being in my life. I love
you. Thank you.
Truly, truly love you. And I'm honored to call you my godmother.
Thank you, and I'm honoured that you're my goddaughter. And the time we both shared the same platform was...
Who would have ever thought that? Just like, my God, like doing workshops at the same conference. And you know, the audience didn't know that we knew each other.
I didn't know watching you. Just not. Okay, I see. I'll go with it.
So the thing is, I've known her for years because of the days of camp. And she says, oh, so do you know Novlet Aldred? Because she's going to be on it. I burst out laughing. She's like, why are you laughing? I said, because Novlet's my godmother. And she's like, and I just remember Carl Smith was on there. She says, so do you know Carl Smith? I says, yeah, his youngest daughter is like a child. She's like, I'm going to stop talking to you. And then there was another young lady there, Karen. She goes, do you know Karen? I'm like, yeah, I've done work with her brother. It was amazing and a real honor for me to be on the same platform as you, and I don't take it lightly at all.
No, me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, and love you, and all the best.
And I'll speak to you soon.
Yes, okay, we must.
Yes, definitely.
Take care. Yeah, God bless. Take care. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
Thank you for spending time with us. We're already looking forward to the next episode of This is Conversations with Allison J. The journey to here. Until next time, honor, respect, and blessings to you all. If you want to connect, visit AllisonJ.net. That's AllisonJaye.net. Allison with one L, as she is the one and only.